Hi there. Wow. Hey, let's get this Fandango started, this hootenanny. Let's get it afoot. How are you guys doing, yeah? Doing all right? You look great. You really do. You look great. You might have heard about this thing called touch. It's kind of a big deal lately. A lot of us are starting to think about touchscreen designs. And I think it's kind of flipping the way that we think about designing interfaces literally on its head in many cases because of the ergonomics of touchscreen design. In general, I think that touch forces in many ways, or should force, important and really fundamental changes in how we approach the designs of our interfaces, not actually just as designers, but as users, as consumers, too. I think that touch is going to help us to sweep away decades of buttons and tabs and menus and folders and all this administrative debris that we've accumulated over the last 30 years of the desktop interface. Because the thing is, when you remove this thing, the cursor, and of course the mouse too, these prosthetics that we've been using to point at stuff for the last three decades, all that remains is you and the device, or better, you and the content. At least that's the illusion that we have the opportunity to create, right? I mean, interfaces are all about illusion. And so we're just getting to a situation where the illusion that we create with our interfaces can have a real sort of physical feel to them, become more realistic and sort of rhyme with the way that we naturally understand the world. I think that it cuts through complexity to be able to interact directly with content almost as a physical object than from pumping buttons, for example, and I'll talk about that in a bit. So this is a big shift, I think, a real change in the way that we think about interface design to interact with the content directly. We have to think about it in terms of new models. And it's a challenge not only for software designers, but as I said, for us as consumers too. You know, how do we help people learn to use software without buttons? You know, how do we teach touch? And first, I guess I should start with, you know, what's the big deal? I mean, sure, touch is sort of an interesting gimmick that we can slide content around. That's kind of fun. But it's more than just a gimmick. It's that when you introduce this touchscreen interface, traditional point-and-click conventions are actually kind of crummy on touch screens. So just as a sort of a quick example of that, this is especially true on big touch screens. So when you look at, for example, email in the iPad app, and lots of iPad apps follow this convention of having this button in the top left, right, that triggers sort of a pull-down menu. So if I'm here looking at my email from ThinkGeek, and by the way, if you don't already get everything that you need in life from thinkgeek.com, you really should, because it's fantastic. That's my little public service announcement for the day. But if I'm here and I'm looking at this email and I want to go back out to my sent mail, right, I have to reach up to this tiny little button in the top left and then hit this whole series of buttons, right? I've got this giant screen, and yet I'm asked constantly to peck at this tiny little portion of the corner. This big, expansive screen that so much of the interaction is in this one little, tiny patch of it, and it seems sort of wasteful. It seems actually a little bit difficult to sort of always kind of have to lift my whole arm up to get at it. And frankly, sometimes it makes me a little crazy, a little antsy. I might just be a little oversensitive. In fact, I'm just going to give that another hit. Yeah. Hates the back button, but love keynote animations. That's my shtick. I'm going to make a t-shirt. I'm going to zazzle that shit. So the Fitts' Law comes into place here, and a lot of you are probably familiar with Fitts' Law. It's something that emerged from this model that was actually done, you know, half a century ago to essentially measure how long it takes people to move an object to a target using some kind of a pointer. Think about a puck and a shuffleboard stick. And basically what the model found, it's not really a big surprise, pretty common sense conclusion, the further away a target is and the smaller it is, the longer it takes and the harder it is to hit it. It's what makes golf such a miserable sport. Fitts' Law. So it's actually used in terms of the models that we often use for desktop design. You know, it works for you know, how to, in terms of sort of usability and ergonomics, how hard is it to hit a button with the cursor? It turns out that it maps really well for touchscreens, too. even though it's not using a sort of a pointer or a prosthetic, it's actually using your finger, the model fits, especially as you get to larger touch screens. So the further away that the target is, the harder it is to hit. And so even though buttons on an iPhone, for example, are the same size as the buttons on the iPad, it takes more effort and concentration to hit that little button in the corner, because I'm not just sort of sweeping a phone with my thumb. I'm raising this big, you know, meat pointer all the way up to the corner to hit it. So it takes physical effort, and it takes a certain amount of cognitive effort, too. See, this should be our motto as designers, right? You know, let me be as lazy as I want to be. Don't make me concentrate on hitting these little buttons. Let me swipe at the whole screen, not just a tiny little plot of it. So do you even need buttons at all when you've got this whole screen to use? Very simple example. It's an iPad app called Pinball HD. And it's a simulation of a pinball game, which we really specifically associate with buttons, right? I mean, to sort of work the flippers. And yet this game has no buttons. In fact, the whole screen is a button, really, or really two buttons. Tap anywhere on the left to hit that left flipper, anywhere on the right to get the right flipper. And pull down on the plunger to send the ball up. So you can interact directly with this, with the entire screen, without having to sort of worry about where precisely you're hitting it. Now, I don't want to say that buttons are bad or that you should never use buttons, particularly as we, you know, continue to develop a gesture vocabulary. We're going to need visible controls or hints to help people, and I'll be talking about that in the second half of this. How do we inform people and make it really easy and intuitive for them to find these gestures, these touch points, without visible cues? But in many cases, we will need these visual cues, especially for abstract actions. You know, I don't know what the gesture is for send to Twitter. I don't know what that should be. So a lot of times, like a button will help for that. But that doesn't mean that we can't also have alternatives. So give me shortcuts to supplement the button. You know, keep the button, but give me a gesture to speed through the navigation. So when Apple released iOS 5, that's finally what they did, so I didn't have to keep tapping that little button in the top left corner, making me so angry. Instead, you could just swipe out this little drawer, right? And swipe it back, too. You know, and think about similar time-saving gestures. You know, maybe we can just do a five-finger touch to bring up specifically sent mail, for example. There are issues with this. Not everybody has five fingers. You know, and there are accessibility issues to this that are real. So that means that gestures, especially these sort of more abstract multi-touch gestures, need to be thought of as alternatives to the sort of to buttons, not as the only way to do things, as supplements. You know, one way to really think about this is that gestures are the keyboard shortcuts of touch. You know, this is the real advantage of gestures, particularly multi-touch gestures. They let you move quickly through the interface, really quickly and naturally, without mashing buttons. Expert shortcuts for time-consuming actions. That's the motivation behind most custom gestures, in nearly all non-game apps, at least. So what makes some shortcuts? You know, it's the time-saving aspect that you can just slap at the whole screen without concentration, or even with more of a flip of the wrist rather than moving your whole arm. It's a very simple example of that. It's a reader, a feed reader for Google that I think is a good example of this. So it's a news feed reader, and so here here's what it looks like if I'm in a specific feed, looking at a specific website and looking at an article. There is a back button that I can go back to my list of other feeds. But even better, I can just pinch the whole screen closed. And I can pinch again to go back to the groups that I've organized those things in. This fast, quick action that uses the entire screen as a control. And it's pleasing, you know? It's like I don't have to raise my arm at all. It's just sort of pinching through things. It's as pleasing as being able to swipe and slap through a photo gallery, right? Point here is that especially when you're dealing with tablets, and this is really especially what I'm talking about here, big screens invite big gestures. You don't have to hit that little button all the time. Let me just swipe at the whole thing to take an action. Now, I've been talking about this in the context of particularly ergonomics and effort and maybe a little bit about concentration. But there's also sort of a more important conceptual issue here, and that's this, that buttons are a hack. And, I, you know, this is something that I've been saying a lot for the last year or so, and sometimes people get surprisingly upset about somebody saying that buttons are a hack. I don't actually mean it in any particularly negative way. I think buttons are an inspired hack. Especially, you know, and I'm talking about in the real world, too, not just in terms of our virtual world of interface design. You know, if you think about physical buttons and switches, a light switch over there to turn on a light over here is not particularly intuitive, right? Something that has to be described, discovered, and learned. It's why I spend more time than I really care to admit in other people's bathrooms looking around in the dark, right? It's not an obvious connection between the primary object, the light, and this control that I have over here. Buttons, switches, these things are middlemen. You know, they introduce a layer of abstraction and separation between me and the primary object. They don't do it, you know, and we don't introduce these things just to make things harder or more abstract. We do it because they're necessary workarounds. You know, that light switch, even though it might be hard to find at first, is a much better alternative to going into a dark room with a ladder and climbing up to the ceiling and, you know, screwing around with the light bulb. Or, you know, even just screwing the light bulb in. You don't have to screw around with it, I guess. So the thing is that in the same way that buttons and switches have been useful hacks in the real world, that's sort of the way to think about it in terms of our interface design of the last 30 years. We introduced all these abstractions, this interface for the desktop, that, you know, because we had it to. We had to have some sort of abstraction for that. And with touch, we have an opportunity to close that gap. Buttons still have a role. All these controls still have a role. But the point is that it's important for us as designers as we get new interface models, speech, touch, facial recognition, gestures like the Kinect system, to start thinking about, wow, do I still need that workaround anymore? Or is there another more natural way that I can do this interface? My point here is just that, you know, our brains evolved over a gajillion years, I believe is the technical time span, to explore the physical world. You know, don't be trapped by this temporary, alternate, arbitrary universe that's only existed for 30 years of computer interfaces. You know, designed for humans. We have this sort of opportunity now to explore that as we're getting these new interface models, like touch, like speech. I mean, even Microsoft is getting this religion, right? As a lot of you know, Windows 8, already out in consumer preview, the fancy word for beta, I guess. It's going to be a touch-based OS. You know, it's all touch and gestures. UI inspired by Windows Phone, and before that, the Zune. You remember the Zune, the little poo-colored music player? Really popular, I'm sure a lot of you have it. And like those systems, you know, you would just swipe through. You just, you know, touch, interact with the content directly. Look at how you switch apps. Just swipe at the side of the screen, like little cards, right? Moving through this. You'll see how this pans out. There's going to be sort of a weird, if you've played with it at all, you see that there's this strange combination of this Metro-style interface with old-style Windows, and it's a little bit jarring. There's sort of a Frankenstein effect of these things being kind of bolted onto each other. But the point is that Microsoft's embrace of this in Windows, you know, shows that in a really big mainstream way, there's this real momentum moving us out of this old notion of UI and more into this direct touch physical metaphor. You know, another example, you know, goodbye passwords. With Windows 8, you're going to be able to sign in with gestures on a photo, for example. So instead of having like a numeric or alphanumeric password, I'll be able to just sort of draw essentially a pattern onto this picture. So for example, I could just draw a circle here around Dad, maybe draw a line between my sisters, punch Mom in the face, and I'm logged in. So how do we start thinking about designing this stuff? Well, I want to sort of talk a little bit about Twitter as an example of sort of how you might move away from sort of a button-based thing, just thinking about very simple physical interactions. So Twitter for iPad did away with the back button entirely. I mean, Twitter's sort of official apps very much emphasize exploration of drilling down through a lot of content. And that's very clear here in the iPad app, for example, where here I am in my feed, I tap on a tweet, I get the web page that's in there, I look at the profile, I want to see what tweets are in there. And see, I've got the stack. It's now going off to the left, and I can swipe back through my history. No need to have a back button. Every one of those panels represents a slice of content, a little moment in history. This physical representation of that particular slice of my experience that then I can just move back and forth through. And we often think about these things in terms of pages, and this sort of makes it very physical by turning it into this sort of card metaphor. No need to have a back button for that. Just move through it. I mean, I think that for a lot of people who first came to it, it was sort of disconcerting, a sort of a strange experience at first. But then once you use it more, it's this very natural thing of being able to move through these cards. I've been talking a lot about apps, and I want to sort of say, well, so where is the web in all this? Frankly, this new class of devices is creating expectations for interaction that really the web isn't that great at yet. There are sort of a lot of reasons for that, and I'll give sort of a couple reasons for those. There are really two things that we need to sort of be able to make gestural interaction on the web even sort of possible, let alone plausible. And one is sort of real support for gestures. Because out of the box, JavaScript developers have this really weak broth to work with. I mean, look at this crap. This is it. Touch start, touch move, touch end. Go ahead. Now do your multi-touch, five-finger gesture swipe thing. You know, no, you've got to build it all from scratch. There's no sort of abstracted notion of gestures of a pinch or a rotate or even a two-finger touch or a swipe. You've got to build all that stuff directly. The second thing, and you've got to do that a bit in the native SDKs too, but there's some more of this abstraction, this notion of gestures that are sort of built into the system already. But part of the reason is that we don't have very good gesture conventions yet. I mean, on the web, basically we have two so far. They are tap and swipe. Frankly, it's not that much better in apps yet either. Although you can do sort of multi-touch gestures in a lot of apps, we still don't have a lot of conventions there, right? A two-finger swipe in this app does something completely different in that one, even if they're the same class of apps. I'm looking at you, magazines. Wow, you have to learn how to read a new magazine every time you get a new edition, because they all do things differently, right? So we need to do much better to develop gesture conventions together that work on all platforms. It's a little tricky, especially for the web. I mean, when you build a web app, it's running in this little emulator called a browser, and the browser has its own controls and gestures, and the operating system has controls and gestures over that. So you have to, if you're building your web app, not conflict with any of those other gestures up the stack, and those may be different on different platforms. So it's hard to come up with any sort of real sophisticated gesture conventions on the web and think it will evolve, but it's a real challenge for us. What we shouldn't do is leave these decisions to the operating systems and the tool makers. You know, for magazines, for example, who are all using, for example, Adobe's digital publishing suite or Woodwing, leaning on these things, those tool makers are deciding what that interaction is like. And I think that we need to have better sort of design decisions in there. We need to be in there. And so I think we have to be a little bit active and conversational about how to develop those conventions. I'll talk about that in a little bit. In the meantime, for the web, you know, swiping isn't too bad, isn't too hard to do. You know, so you see this in a lot of places like in Flickr on their slideshow. If you go to it in iPad, you know, you can swipe through the gallery. New York Times has this carousel in the middle of the front page that you can swipe through. You can also swipe to previous and next articles on the New York Times. Google Image Search, you can swipe through that. So it's, you know, sort of thinking about at least introducing swipes to start to get an audience used to the fact that you can have gestures in your websites is important. But you can do more complex things, too, if you sort of put your mind to it. Browser Ninja is a clone of the game app Fruit Ninja, with pieces of little fruit fly up into the air, in this case, browser icons, and you can just swipe at them, you know, with your fingers, with multi-touch gestures. So this is an HTML5 app. It's a little wonky, but it's still sort of a good proof of concept that you can do multi-touch game kind of animation stuff on the web, but it's not easy to do. JavaScript libraries are coming in. We've got jQuery Mobile that supplements these three very basic JavaScript things with more abstract gestures like tap, swipe, and long tap. Sentient Touch is a lot more sort of robust in this sense. It supplements not only those things that we just saw in jQuery Mobile, it also gives us these things, the double tap, drag, pinch, and rotate. Sentient Touch is really an impressive piece of work, but it's something that also kind of, you really have to commit to it. It only targets WebKit browsers. So if you're interested in looking at, you know, Windows Mobile or in particular other platforms or older BlackBerry, you're kind of out of luck if you want to use it for that. So it's a pretty amazing piece of engineering, but it's something that is a little bit hard to embrace for everyone. Relative newcomer, and this, then I'll sort of leave the code stuff behind. This is a small JavaScript library to help handle touch events and especially design big multi-touch, sort of more complex actions. It's still complicated, but it abstracts away a lot of the stuff that you can just sort of actually have better control and understanding of what individual fingers are doing on the screen. So another one to look at. So the web is kind of coming along, but it's really native apps that are leading the way and are a real experimental sandbox for figuring out this future of gestural interaction. So I want to return to that and just give an idea of the kinds of experiments that we're seeing. Here's an experiment put together by a designer named Moritz Harman. It's a demo that he created as an example of navigating content without controls, using the IKEA catalog content, touching directly. This is running in the simulator. That's why it's a cursor instead of a finger. It feels odd at first, but you see what's happening? You're like manipulating the content directly, no buttons, touching the content itself. And as you drill in, higher up hierarchy sort of shrink into the distance. And other stuff comes up bigger in the foreground. And you can sort of manipulate the whole hierarchy that way, touching the content that you want to see. Another one that you've probably seen in the last month or two is a to-do list app called Clear. We get some sound. There we go. Were the keyboard, right? And that's still a pretty legitimate use for buttons, right? But looking at that, didn't it seem almost more like he was playing it than using it? I mean, that's one of the things that gestural interaction gives us the opportunity to do, is to create apps and interfaces that are more like playing an instrument than using a tool. Almost like the way most of you have become with keyboards, right? Just sort of this effortless physical interaction that takes no overhead or processing. You don't have to process the labels and abstractions of the interface. You just have this almost physical understanding of it that you don't even have to think about. I'll talk about that in a little bit. So gestures give us the opportunity to make apps that are like instruments, apps that you play more than you can use. But to do that, especially with sort of this direct touch interaction, a lot of times we have to rethink kind of old and familiar ways of doing stuff. I'm going to give you an example. This is an app called TouchUp. And TouchUp is an app that lets you basically paint filters or colors or do sort of touch-up things onto a photo. It's sort of like a photo editor, but it's also sort of got some sort of artsy stuff to it. The most sort of simple thing, just to give you a quick example, is, you know, you can just sort of paint onto a photo. So what if you want to change the brush size? We all know how to do this, right, on the desktop. This is a solved problem. Two ways to do it, right? Some kind of slider that changes the size, or maybe a palette where you choose your brush, right? The trouble with touch is that you already have a brush, you know, and it doesn't change size. If you do something weird to sort of be like, oh, when you touch your finger down, it's going to make a different impression on the screen, now that introduces uncertainty, because I don't know exactly what's going to happen when my finger touches, right? How big of a paint blot am I going to leave? So TouchUp turns this on its head. Instead of changing the brush size, you change the canvas size. And then you paint on it again. Your finger leaves the same trace, but it's the canvas size that has changed size. So sometimes you sort of have to think in sort of subtly new ways about old ways that we've solved problems because of the physicality that's involved here. And speaking of that, I'd sort of, in talking about new ways, I want to talk about an older approach. This is the Wenger giant. There's no Photoshop shenanigans here. This is a honest-to-God Swiss Army knife, the Guinness World Record holder for most multifunctional pen knife. 87 tools that amount to over 140 functions. There's a golf reamer in here. There's a laser pointer in there someplace. And actually, guys, my personal favorite is a key ring. Right? You're never going to lose those again. This thing's 4 pounds and over 9 inches. All right, old man getting back on the stage. Oh, yeah. So this thing is obviously ridiculous, right? But intentionally so. It was made for the 100th anniversary of the Wenger Company, one of the two companies that makes the official Swiss Army knife. And their idea was, man, it's our 100th anniversary. Let's take every gadget that we've ever put into a Swiss Army knife and make one bitchin' Swiss Army knife. And this is the result. It's sort of, so it's a bit of humor and whimsy from the Swiss. But as a knife, it's a little bit of a failure, right? It's a pocket knife that won't fit in your pocket. I don't want to sort of beat up too much on it, on this as sort of a case of usability, because it wasn't ever really intended to be used. I mean, you certainly don't want to use the toothpick when everything's open here. The point that I want to make, though, is that in a mobile interface, which this certainly is, clarity always trumps density. With most interfaces, the more features that you have, the more controls you need, right? I mean, that's sort of our essential tension as designers of these kinds of tools. If you put too much into a small space, you get something like this that's ergonomically unsuited to its purpose. Too complicated. A wonderful thing about touch gestures is that they can let us remove Chrome, let us remove the visual clutter, and yet still have the kind of features and interaction that we might otherwise have to choke up the interface with. There's a big problem here, though, with this, right, of layering in all these complex, fancy gestures, is how do people find out about them? You know, gestures are invisible. They're unlabeled. The only cues that we have are past experience or any visual hints that the app itself gives us. The less that a gesture resembles a physical action, the more difficult it is to find, right? So more abstract gestures tend to go overlooked. I mean, just sort of the simple pinch gesture that I was showing in the Reader app there, that Google Reader app to close and go back up the hierarchy. People have used this thing for a couple years, never knew about that. Avid fans of the app. So something's wrong there, right? We need to do a better job of helping people figure this stuff out. I'll be talking for the rest of the time about how we can do that. The thing that I want to say, though, is that, you know, first off, like I said, people will figure stuff out if it resembles a physical action, or if it resembles something from experience that they've had with the desktop. So in Google Maps, for example, people immediately figure out that they can double tap the map to zoom in. It has no physical, you know, doing that on a regular map obviously doesn't do anything, but they figure that out immediately because they know that double click action from the desktop. What they won't figure out is that in iOS, for example, in the Maps app, a two-finger single touch will zoom out. Why would anyone ever even try that? You know, it's totally abstract, and there's no hint or reason that they would be able to discover that. So the way that we need to think about helping people with gestures is to train them by using conventions that they already understand or by introducing visual hints that they can use to learn these things. Understand that with a little bit of help, people will learn to work your interface sight unseen. And in fact, we do this all the time. You know, we use interfaces daily that are essentially invisible, or at least in the dark. Who wakes up to this sound still? Anybody? Yeah, did you guys just have a heart attack? Yeah, sorry, I was like, it's like that wake-up sound. It's a little bit. a lot of us can turn this thing off in our sleep, you know, let alone whether it's labeled or visible or not. It's like, wow, we can do it in our sleep, you know? It's muscle memory, like typing. I mean, it turns out that if you ask professional typists, which incidentally, I guess we all are now, you know, my mom asked me, what is it you do again? I'm a typist. If you ask a typist to put, you know, and there's like studies from, this is like from the 60s, where they would ask these typists to write down the order of keys on the keyboard. Couldn't do it. Now, these were like, whatever, 100 word per minute flying through the keyboard typists, and they didn't actually know what they were typing. It had gone out of visual memory and into muscle memory, which is much faster to access, right? Like, again, you know, all of you with keyboards, just intent fluidly transferred to action. That's where we want to get people to be with our interfaces, no matter what type of interface it is, right? But how do we get there? I mean, the trouble with both of these examples, with the clock, had to, like, actually learn the clock before we could turn it off in our sleep, right? Likewise with typing, we all started with hunt and peck, touch typing. You had to learn it somewhere from these visual cues. Nearly everything we know has to be taught and learned, you know, observed and then repeated with practice. So before we get to helping people find invisible gestures, I want to talk about the importance of visual cues. This is the OCD chef cutting board. It's for the obsessive compulsive chef who wants to make sure that they get their julienne and allumette cuts exactly right. Before you sort of have absorbed that into sort of instinct, you have a cheat sheet like this. And we fill our lives with these all the time, either with our own personal systems, our own personal sort of reference, or softer reminders that are provided for us, often social, and not entirely in our control as either designers or consumers. Don Norman wrote a book, came out last year, called Living with Complexity. And if you're familiar with Don's work, a lot of the content will feel familiar. It sort of combines a lot of the concepts from his other books and then refreshes it with newer examples. And so it's a great book. In it, though, he talks about salt and pepper shakers. Let me just ask, quick show of hands, who thinks this is salt? Pepper? Who has no idea? About evenly split among the three. Don points out, actually doesn't matter what's correct. All that matters is what the person who filled these things think, right? That's why if you go to a restaurant or somebody else's house, even if you're like, sure, that is of course salt, you never just dump it on, right? You always test it. So this introduces uncertainty, because social conventions, we know, even if we're certain that we know what's right, we don't trust that everyone else understands them. You know, social signifiers only work if everyone knows them, and cultural understanding is messy. User interfaces are social conventions. This is cultural understanding. We happen to be the ones as designers who are filling the salt shakers, so we're in a little bit of a position of power here. But until we get real conventions for things, which have finally gelled, for example, in the desktop UI and are now only beginning to evolve for touch interfaces, until we have those, there's a lot of uncertainty for our users. So our job as the hosts filling the shakers is to give people confidence. So we use sort of lots of different ways to try to do this. Labels is one way. Oh, great. This gives a hint about which is pepper and which is salt, right? That begins to give some confidence. But isn't this better? I mean, why have a label when you can just see the content? You want the salt? Grab the salt. You know, there's no extra processing there. Understand, this is still a social convention, because you'd be surprised if that was sugar, right? But it's a better understood social convention. It's one that's become more established. Again, who needs a control or a label when you have the content itself to speak for it? You see this a lot in touchscreen apps, and particularly in photo galleries, really dense amounts of content where the content itself is the control. Which photo do you want? Just touch the thumbnail, and you get it. Now, salt and pepper shakers, photo galleries, these again are direct calls to action. right? I mean, it's sort of obvious. These are these visual cues. But I think that one thing that's really important is to start thinking about, right, what are the opportunities where I can make the content itself the control? I don't need a button. I can actually work directly on the content. These are some simple examples of that. And I think it's actually somewhat promising. I mean, in the 60s, Marshall McLuhan famously said, the medium is the message. I think we may finally be moving to a place where the message is the medium. The content is the control. You know, the information is the interface. You can have lots of features and complex information without having all the chrome. You don't have to be that Vinger giant. But again, as I said, glass salt shakers and photo thumbnails are these obvious visual cues. So let's turn to those more abstract behaviors, like those pinch gestures, like multi-touch gestures. How do we teach those? Well, a lot of times we start here, right? Instructions. Make people read a manual before you get started. You see this a lot in magazine apps right now. Before you use the popular science iPad app, you have to sort of hit this screen and see all of the various gestures that they recommend that you use. New Yorker does this too. A lot of apps do this. Like, wow, all right, we've got to tell them everything. We've got to tell them how to use this thing. The trouble is that I haven't, you know, you're giving me this really sort of complex set of instructions. I haven't even seen the app yet. I don't even know what it does yet. This isn't going to gel with me much. Even worse, it makes it seem more complicated than it already is. You know, I mean, reading an iPad magazine app, even if it works differently from another one, it's not really all that hard. But this sure makes it seem hard. Coy Vinh, the former design director for New York Times Digital, did a little send-up of these magazine instructions and took a stab at looking at what would it be like if you had to read this before you read an actual print magazine. I like this. It's, you have, on the left here, it says, pages stacked on the left side display your reading history. And on the right, pages display your unread content. It's nice. It's very in the top right corner there. They helpfully show you how to bookmark. You know, you can come back to that content later. But doesn't this make it seem more complicated than it actually is? You know? Upfront instruction manuals make your app seem harder. Norwegian TV had a comedy sketch many years ago titled Medieval Help Desk. Can you guys in the back, can you read these captions? You can read them out if you can't, yeah? Can somebody raise your hand if you can read it or just keep them down, yeah? Anybody want me to read them? I'll read them. All right, so the Medieval Help Desk. The situation is that the book has just been invented and scroll readers everywhere are in a panic, because they can't figure out how to read these things. So this monk, confused, has called the help desk in to help him out with his book. We're coming into the middle of this thing, where he's had a little bit of a tutorial, and he thinks he's got it. And he's saying, you know, well, when you're used to paper scrolls, it takes some time to get used to turning the pages of a book, okay, I've got it. Right, a book, so then everything's all right then? Yeah, just one last thing. Let's run through it once before you leave. So I open it like this, and then I, how did you say? You turn the page. Okay, I turn the page back and forth, and when I'm finished, I just close it. Oh, great. Yep, nice. All right, thanks. See ya. Oh, wait, I can't believe it. It's like this again. I can't open it. You're doing it with the wrong side up. What do you mean wrong? You have to open it from the other side. So it does matter which way you open it? Yeah, you have to open it from this side. Oh, I see. Well, have you read the manual? The manual? Yeah, it comes with this guide for users. Here it is. It has the same problem. I can't seem to open it. Hadn't thought of that. Look, even if he could read it, he wouldn't read it, because none of us read manuals. This is why all of us think that Monopoly is this long game that never ends. It's because we don't read the instructions. Turns out if you actually read the instructions and stop making up your own rules, like, oh, free parking has free money, whatever, the stuff that makes the game go on forever, if you actually follow the instructions, it's a pretty fast game. I mean, it's still a brutal, cruel, awful game, but it goes quickly at least, right? Why don't we read the instructions? Because this doesn't seem like a nice way to spend an evening with the family, right? We're impatient. You know, we have a goal when we're using a product or software or playing a game. and instructions seem to get in the way of the game, even though it may actually get to our goal faster. We want to jump into it. As a result, all of us have only incomplete knowledge of the tools that we use every day. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't include a complete reference with your software. Just don't treat it as a learning guide, because your users won't. So because nobody will use your manual to learn how to use your stuff, we often try show and tell instead, maybe using this guy. I should be careful, because I understand he's rattling around here this weekend. So Al Gore, he wrote a book called Our Choice, and it's been adapted into an e-book. It's about the environment, of course. It's adapted into an e-book by a company called Push Pop Press that was later acquired by Facebook. So unfortunately, I'm not sure we'll see more e-books from them. Wonderful interactions, right? Really smart, button-free interface. Largely self-explanatory, but Al took no chances, so he launches the app with this video.
This app is a new kind of book that combines text and images, as well as video, interactive infographics, and my own audio commentary.
I don't know why.
All to help bring this important message to life. You can browse through the different chapters by swiping through the visual table of contents, or browse through a chapter by scrolling through the pages at the bottom. To start reading, use two fingers to pop a page open. To go back to the table of contents, just pinch the page down. You'll find images, movies, and interactive infographics resting on the pages throughout the app. You can pick anything up using two fingers and pop it open. Tap the globe in the corner to see a photo's location on an interactive map.
Interactive.
Pinch to return to the page you were reading. Movies work the same way.
Most modern wind turbines consist of a large...
Some images unfold to reveal the other half. Some photos have audio commentary.
Industrial agriculture now uses 10 calories of energy.
A hand icon marks our choices' interactive infographics. Pop one open and use your finger to explore the data. I hope that you will enjoy this new reading experience.
Well, me too, Al, because you just sucked the joy out of my first 2 minutes. But wow, what great interactions, right? I mean, it's like amazing, you know, really, for the most part, there are a few sort of tricky things there about like unfolding an image maybe. But most of the stuff, wow, I could figure that out pretty quickly. I'm not even sure that I need these instructions. Really thoughtful, interesting, gestural interactions going on there. But look, complex actions will require some instruction. And as I've said, we have to give some visual hints to let people know how to work your app. It's important to understand, though, that instruction can come in many forms, not just a manual or a lecture, although that's often where we start. That's where we fall back so often. The best interfaces, of course, require no instruction. Nature itself doesn't have labels, and neither do the most obvious and useful designs. This doesn't mean that nature is an easy interface. In fact, it's a really difficult, challenging, perplexing interface. That's why toddlers look like morons for like 3 years of their life, because they can't figure out what the heck is going on, right? They're surprised constantly. We've invested a lot of time in learning this interface, the natural interface. So I think that we should, as designers, embrace and lean on that learned and acquired knowledge so that we don't require much additional instruction. The physicality of touch interfaces, whether they're sort of naturalistic or whether they're really, you know, up sort of 2D kind of Windows phone sort of tiles sliding around, either way, the physicality of these things sort of tickles our brain in new ways. It means that we don't have to learn new ways to do things. If done right, it's a big if. Realistic 3D design, so-called skeuomorphic design, can invite touch, not just an, ooh, I want to touch that, but actually giving instruction in how you use these touch interfaces. Apple emphasizes this a lot in its human interface guidelines for the iPad. Make it realistic. It will, you know, be, people will embrace it emotionally and they'll understand it immediately. Trouble is that you have to do a lot more than just add some Photoshop textures to make this work. And Apple's own apps show the hazards there. Here's the calendar app for iPad. And, you know, it's a lovely date book. And of course, you know how to use it, right? It's a book, you can just flip the pages. Until just a couple of months ago, though, with iOS 5, for the first 18 months that the iPad app was out, you'd go to, you know, flip the page to the next day. Wait a sec. No. No, nothing. In fact, you know, you see that tiny little arrow in the bottom right there, that little tiny itty-bitty thing that's probably already disappeared into your soft belly while you're on your Barca lounger? That's what you use. Can you believe it? You tap that, and that's how it goes. It's actually worse, though, in the address book. So in the Contacts app, you go to swipe a page, you actually start deleting content. Yeah, thanks, Apple. That's great. Now, look, I don't mean to beat up on Apple. They've done more than any other company or group of designers to move this sort of touch interface stuff forward. The fact that their apps still aren't getting it right just shows how difficult it is and how much we still need to sort of step back again from these conventions that we've learned as designers, but that our users aren't necessarily quite so beholden to. So don't make me, you know, use desktop-style buttons when your app looks like I should be able to turn the page and work it like a book. You know, embrace your interface. If you're going to go the route of aping a physical object, embrace that metaphor. You know, think hard about the new interaction opportunities, not only that it proposes, but that it promises. You know, in user testing, I see this all the time. Again, if it looks like a physical object, people are going to try to interact with it like one. And we've used these stunts all the time, right? For as long as graphic design has been a practice, we've done little things on paper to make things look like a 3D object. It's eye candy, right? But for a touch interface, it suddenly takes on new meaning. Oh, this is instruction for how I use this. That's what the interface is. Instruction for how you use it. And in fact, it turns out to be misdirection in a lot of cases. Meanwhile, you have magazine apps often that are too literal. Basically just linear PDFs of the print edition. They're easy. You know how to use them. You just sort of swipe through in this linear way. But because so often they even make it hard to find tables of contents, you lose one of the big digital advantages, you know, of digital content, which is random access, being able to leap directly to one point to another. So as you embrace realistic interfaces, it's really important to remember to enable what digital media can do best, which is to unshackle us from these linear reading experiences. So here's an example, sort of tweaking the real world to digital advantage. The Sydney Morning Herald has this iPad app that looks very much sort of very newspapery, and as you might expect, you can, you know, flip through the pages like you would a newspaper, very sort of casual browsing. But also at the bottom, you have these little page indicators that show your progress through the edition. And if you touch that, it shows the list of articles on the page. So you can quickly scan through the entire issue in a very sort of rapid way, or you have the option to kind of do this slower thing. So it splits the difference in what I consider to be a very clever way of having this physical, familiar artifact, but then also be able to have instant random access to content. So on the one hand, you have things like calendar and contacts where designers are following their metaphor kind of half-heartedly in terms of interaction. And then you have magazines where they're following it too literally and missing interaction possibilities. And this is, you know, understandable. Tablets, the iPad, definitely a weird hybrid. You know, it's not the web, it's not a phone, it's not the desktop, it's not a paper or physical interface. I mean, as Apple is very fond of saying, this is a new category of computing. And we haven't yet exactly embraced the right way to use that medium. So great opportunities, lots of tradition to draw from, but you have to be careful about mixed metaphors. Just one more little slap at Apple here. Sometimes you've just got the wrong metaphor. So this is the voice memo app for iPhone. And it's gorgeous, right? I mean, look at this lovely, beautiful retro microphone. But what does it do? Do I speak into it? No, the microphone is on the other side of the phone at the bottom. So there's already some misdirection there. Can I touch it? Doesn't do anything. This whole app is all about starting and stopping voice recording. And yet that entire activity is limited to that tiny corner in the bottom left. I don't know, what would be a better interface? How about a giant record button on the thing? Use the whole screen as a control. Because a lot of times using these sort of metaphors can be misdirection if you're not careful. It's important to model your apps on the way that people learn, you know, the same way that they learn in the real world. Right from our earliest days, as I've said, we rely on physical hints about how something works. And we verify that through the feedback that the world gives us. Watch how toddlers use the iPad. You guys have seen toddlers use an iPad, at least on YouTube, right? And cats are using iPad on YouTube. Cats do everything on YouTube. It's amazing how quickly toddlers get it, right? This direct manipulation of content. Tap the content directly, they can figure out how to move things across the screen, you know, nudge views out of the way. They're not going to get your multi-level menu navigation, but that's all right, because neither will your adult users. Follow the toddlers. They're better at this than we are. They haven't been poisoned by 30 years of desktop interface conventions. They're able to figure this stuff out immediately. In fact, in general, right, you look at sort of the two extremes, the very young and the very old, people who have very limited computing experiences, and they're the ones that, wow, figure this thing out immediately. Toddlers are better at this than we are. Find a three-year-old and make her your beta tester. I'm serious. Think, you know, what would my four-year-old niece do with this? Would she figure this out? They won't necessarily understand what your app does, but they will figure out the physical implications of how to use the interface. I think it's important to think of yourself a little bit as a parent when you're building these interfaces. Not that you should treat people like babies, patronizing or condescending, just that you should have the same patience and empathy as when you're explaining something new to a child, because many people won't have seen this stuff yet. And so at last, sort of as promised, sort of how to teach those invisible gestures, I think it's useful to look at how kids learn and how we learn using games and toys. First of all, this is going to be your homework assignment. When all is said and done, you've recovered from your hangover from South By, I want you to go to work, sweep whatever it is that your boss gave you to do on your desk, and fire up some video games and tell your boss that you're doing research, because you are. Video games are fantastic at stuff like this. And a lot of times, right, when you start a game, you don't even know what your goal is, you know, let alone what you can do or what obstacles you're going to encounter. The game teaches you as you go, giving you the information that you need in the moment and bringing you along from novice to expert to master. If that sounds familiar, that's the same challenge that we have. So how do we do that with gestural interfaces or with any interface for that matter? Well, this is the way that the games do it. Among other things, video games use these three tools to teach us with visuals and experiences: coaching, leveling up, and power-ups. Let me walk through these quickly. Every modern theory of learning emphasizes the importance of active participation, of active discovery, supplemented by coaching and mentoring. So coaching is basically simple demonstrations, right? Prompts to tell you what to do. This is the app riding along with the user, the game riding along with the player, pointing things out as you go. You know, again, we learn by doing. We learn best in the moment. Telling people how, especially with physical actions, is not nearly as effective as coaching them through. You know, teaching people how to do things is hard. Thinking about playing music or learning a tennis serve, that's not something you learn from reading the manual, right? That's something that's done through demonstration and practice and repetition. You see this a lot in games. So help me in the moment, show me, that's what games do. This iPad game, Dead Space, the very first screen, the very few moments, shows you how to move your guy. This little overlay that says this is how you do it, and it waits for you to do it, nothing else is gonna happen in this room. You just go ahead and do it, and once you figure it out, the tutorial's over, you don't need that overlay anymore, and it's done. So simple, temporary overlays that tell you what to do in the moment can be super helpful. We see this a little bit on the web, with these so-called coach marks, this is Gmail showing you how to use a new feature. You see this a lot of times in Facebook, new tutorial coming up. Now, some of you might be squirming a little bit, because this might seem like a certain interface flop, a flop called Clippy. Clippy was never helpful. He was only a distraction, right? Popping up at the most inconvenient moments.
Once I locate the proper code sequence, this
really boosts the sound.
Allow me to take command of the satellites which control the world's power grid. Once they're under my control, the entire world will be subject to my whims. Go away, you paperclip! No one likes you!
The problem wasn't so much the Clippy concept, right, as the inane content that he had. Clippy had only the dopiest things to say at the most inconvenient times. Done right, though, the assistant feature, like you see in Gmail, Facebook, so many games, a lot of websites, can be helpful to give you the information at the appropriate times and even emphasize the personality of your app. Now, take this guy, for example. You guys know this guy? It's Crazy Dave, right? From Plants vs. Zombies. So this guy shows up frequently to explain story twists, micro games. You know, he's entertaining, he's useful, and he appears for only short periods of time. You know, don't overdo it. Respect people's time. Don't make them read for long. Let them get to the action. You know, animation can actually often do the job pretty well. Just to look quickly at USA Today, this is the iPhone app that came out for USA Today about 3.5 years ago now. So it feels a little bit dated maybe. But they have a really good sort of gimmick to help people learn the navigation. They could go through these top sections here at the top of the navigation, sort of go to the main section, a little dial that you could flip through. See that little L sort of peeking out to the right with a little beveled edge? That sort of indicates there's more there. People didn't get it. They're like, where's the missing content? So they just added a little animation so that every time you visited this screen, that little dial would sort of zoom in from the right, sort of show that stuff. So that there's this hint, oh, this moves. Maybe I can move it too. And they saw adoption go way up. So little hints like that, visual hints, animations, games do this a lot. Here's a little pulsing thing to explore. When you want people to try something out, that's the way to do it. Because a suitcase without a handle is useless. It's just a heavy box. The same goes for a gesture without any visual hint. Visual aids are the handles for your gesture. They're how people get a grip on your interface. So a gesture without a visual aid is useless and inert. Like a suitcase without a handle, it's a dead weight. So you have to provide visual cues for every gesture. Do it through coach marks, animation, illustration, but you have to provide a visual cue, and that's coaching. Super important component of coaching is not showing everything all at once, doing things in terms of levels. You know, the best games have a level that's dedicated to learning a particular skill. In the same way, the first time a user encounters one of your features is the time to sort of show them how to use the thing. I mean, we're most primed to learn a skill right at the moment when you discover that it's needed. You know, that's when we're most motivated, most engaged. Like when a guy with a big sword is about to kick our ass. This is Infinity Blade for iPad, crazy sophisticated combat system, but they make it easy to learn by teaching you one step at a time, introducing challenges, and freezing the action right when you can sort of learn to use this stuff. The game pauses right here when you're about to get your ass kicked. It says, hey, you want to block this? Here's how, and waits for you to do it. So your very first interaction with it is a success. It's okay to sort of pause the action sometime at times like this. Wait till you demonstrate that you understand. Upgrading to Lion, OS X Lion is very much like this. They changed the whole scrolling around, right? So if you were upgrading from OS X Leopard, you actually had to start scrolling in a different direction. Turned the whole gravity of the operating system upside down. When you first install it, they explain it, and they say, here, scroll this window up. It's the only way that you can get to the continue button is to demonstrate that you learned scrolling. And boom, you've beat the first level of OS X Lion. Think about your apps in terms of levels. What's level one in your app? How do you introduce people to new levels of features and skills? Too often we stop at one level. Here's what the app does, okay, good luck. And they're released into the cold wilderness of our software. Lead people through. Where can you help people level up? Last thing I want to talk about is power-ups. The whole concept of levels is about evolving from beginner to expert. And expertise is where the fancy moves come in, right? The power-ups. So in video games, like the Super Mushrooms and Super Mario Brothers. They give you some kind of superpower, right? They turbo boost your game, give you some kind of shortcut or advantage. So power-ups are the keyboard shortcuts of video games, usable by anyone, but especially efficient in the hands of an expert. And that's what gestures are, too. But unlike keyboard shortcuts, as we've said, there's no visual cues, so that we have to either use them as shortcuts, as I said before, for an option that you can do the slow way around, or it provides some visual hints. And I want to talk about doing things the slow way around. I want to sort of start by talking about the Twitter app that was released in iOS. A lot of people, they move things around in the Twitter app, and if you used this, you'll know what I'm talking about. Among other things, they moved direct messages and account switching a level down under this Me tab. Now, they gave you a couple of gestures that you could use to get to account switching and to open your direct messages. It's a little trickier to close it, though. Whoops. You have to sort of hit this down button, done button. So there's these shortcuts that you can use. They don't tell you. You have to discover this yourself. But what would be great, right, is if they said, you know what, do it the slow way. Learn where direct messages are. That builds the mental model for how the app is laid out. But on, say, the 10th time that you hit it, stop, show a demonstration, and make them do it. You know, it's like this is a reward. Achievement unlocked. You've gone to direct messages 10 times. Here's a shortcut. You know, sort of like it's okay to show people explicitly how to do something when they need it. But the fact that this is even needed means that is a demonstration that we don't yet have these conventions sorted out. So it's up to all of us to be more generous. There's like a gajillion people in this room who are apparently interested in gesture stuff. Talk to each other. We've got this whole weekend to do this. What are you doing? What are you trying? Why'd you do that? How's it working out? If you see an app that you like, talk to the designer or developer. This is a time to be generous. We need to sort of develop these conventions as quickly as we can, but not so quickly that we adopt something that's half-baked. So we have to talk. This is really exciting, you guys. I'm excited. Can you tell? I'm excited. Are you excited? Excited. New platforms don't come around just every day. You know, we're just inventing what this stuff does. So it's important to try new things, throw everything that we've got at the drawing board, recognize that sometimes our enthusiasm is an Achilles heel and that we might try some dopey things. It's okay to be sort of have some sober moments and say, does this make sense? But empathy, imagination, an expansive worldview, that's what's going to let us generate these breakthroughs. And so we just have to take that enthusiasm and throw it at this stuff. So we've got the coolest job in the world, you guys. All of us in this room, we're like inventing the future of this stuff together at one of the most exciting times in the history of technology and possibly of culture. So I hope this is sort of helpful to you guys, and I want you to go out and make something amazing. Last thing I just want to say, and I'll let you go. Really, I do. Love you guys. Thank you.